you know that I'll be faithful to you. And that's when really our Lord lays upon him the charge of being a pastor, which is what the charge is of normally of most of our priests. And so we decided to have that triple confession of St. Peter upon our coat of arms. But the three tiers were also there to acknowledge that our fraternity was born in a really particular time. The fraternity of St. Peter was born at a time of crisis within the church. Now, that crisis was reacted to by a lot of different groups in different ways. But the fraternity of St. Peter sees that it has a very specific manner in which it's been called by the church to respond to that crisis which exists within the church. That crisis is something that's not universally acknowledged and wasn't universally acknowledged at the time. But the men who founded the priestly fraternity of St. Peter go all the way back to long before 1988 at the actual moment when we were founded. The men that founded the priestly fraternity of St. Peter go back to the 70s, at least, as far as entering into the seminary. And they entered into a seminary that's not really, at least in its very first stop, isn't very far away from where we have our general house in Fribourg, Switzerland. The first house of formation, the first house that Archbishop Lefebvre founded when he came back from Germany, was a house of formation in the city of Fribourg. Now, it wasn't a seminary at the time. It was a small house used as a sort of headquarters. And at that point, when he came back from Africa, and when he saw the difficulties which were there in seminary training, especially in Europe, he decided, as he had many men coming around him seeking formation, a traditional formation within theology, and simply a Catholic formation of theological studies, he decided to then begin a seminary and begin a house of formation. So the first thing, I guess, to understand as far as a response to that crisis within the church is that it was meant to be a theological one. It was meant to have a theological basis to be able to form men to go out into the world and to be able to preach the faith in all of its integrity, but also to preach the faith in a manner that would change hearts, that would affect the society in which we live, which is something which is fundamentally a difficult problem, right? The Holy Father just wrote an apostolic exhortation about the new evangelization. And we've been talking about the new evangelization now for about 60 years, right? Of saying we need to have a new evangelization, right? And basically what that phrase means fundamentally at the heart of it is that we're in trouble. We're not evangelizing. We're shrinking. There are fewer and fewer Catholics in the world, at least in the Western-speaking world. And the church, to a large degree, has lost its voice in the world which it once had. Now, that voice, as far as having a Catholic voice, is not something that maybe we're as familiar with in the United States, right? Virginia, at least when I grew up in the north, in Minnesota, we thought of Virginia as a very Protestant state, right? It's a proud state of good Protestant founding fathers, and it's not a Catholic majority. We don't think of it that way. But basically, unless excluding Maryland, maybe at its very beginnings, you don't have a Catholic culture which is set out. So it's hard for us to understand a lot of those encyclicals, for example, from the end of the 19th century. Already by the end of the 19th century, you have popes who are saying that the world is going, the church is continuing to go this direction, and the world has started going this direction, right? No one is following any longer that which is taught by the bishops and by the pope, right? So you have an age of enlightenment in which everyone is meant to find the truth on his own as the first principle of truth himself. And so therefore, the church as a reference point, as being the truth, as the reference point for the truth, was by and large lost, right, by these influences which are there. So it's hard for us to imagine, but in 17th century Germany or France, if the bishop of a town said, we're all doing penance today, it's going to be a day of abstinence, no one's going to eat meat, every butcher shop in the town would have been closed, right? There would have been no question about it. The bishop decided what happened civilly within the town. Now, we see that to a certain degree in some places still. We have a priest who's down in Colombia, in the missions in Colombia, in a little mountain town called Analima. When I went to Analima, I was visiting. The priest was there. Our priest, he's walking in the main square of the city right in front of the church and right in front of the mayor's office. So you have the church, you have a big pastor's office, and then the mayor's office is like this big. But no one asked the mayor anything. Everyone asked the priest, you know, for example, if there's domestic dispute or something like that. The two don't go to the mayor, or the husband doesn't have the right to come back until he's talked to the priest. He gets the priest's signature. When he has the priest's signature, then he shows it to the police. Then he's allowed to go back into his family situation. So that sort of standing of the church and the teaching of the church being at the center of life is something that we don't have much of a conception of, right? But it is something which was a part of life in Europe, right? And a part, an integral part of Western culture. And so the whole difficulty of the church addressing the world is a real one, right? So the desire which is there on the part of the Second Vatican Council to address the world in and of itself as a desire is something which is good, right? There is a need for Catholics and the Catholic Church to be able to address the world and to be able to say to the world, what you're doing is wrong, right? Not simply saying to it, what you're doing is not going to get you to heaven, which is the essential message and mission of the church, right? But not only is it not going to get you to heaven, but it's going to make for a disastrous life for you, and it's going to make for a disastrous situation in the society in which we live. So that role of the church is something which is really important. Unfortunately, what happened? What happened is that these documents were published. There are difficulties that are there, certainly within the documents themselves as well. But that the main part of the difficulty was responding to it and going forth from it. So if you say to someone, well, what was the message of the Second Vatican Council to the laity? Most of them will say, well, you should become a lector, or you should become a Eucharistic minister, or you should become a permanent deacon. You should be something within the sanctuary, right? When the message is not that. The message is fundamentally, you should do your duty of state within the world and bring the church insofar as you can to the world in which you live, right? And that's more important than ever now, because those who are doctors, those who are lawyers, those who are politicians, again, their first contact with the church isn't going to be like in the 17th century. They're not going to hear Father preach or myself preach. The first way in which they're going to have contact with the church is because you're a teacher and you teach that child, that man's children, or because you're another doctor or you're a lawyer or he's the man who comes in to see you about this or that. They're going to rub shoulders with you in the public place, and therefore you have to have the capacity as one of the faithful, not simply to say, as happens all too often, even for faithful Catholics, well, we don't do that, we're Catholic. Right? Like, we don't do that, we're Catholic, I'm sorry, we're Catholic, and we just don't do that sort of thing. We realize that you do that sort of thing, but we don't do it, and we can't do it because we're Catholic. Almost as if, well, if we could only break the bonds, we'd be doing exactly what you'd be doing, but we can't because we're Catholic. And the difficulty or the problem with that is, of course, is that because most Catholics are very fearful of making any kind of response, because they don't feel very solid in the formation which they received themselves, because there was a generation, and maybe more than a generation, which by and large wasn't taught anything, almost anything at all. So when dioceses now, I was in the diocese in Sacramento, when they do sociological studies of what went wrong, it always comes back to, they say, well, people who are 50 and 40 and 30 years old don't know any catechism whatsoever, right? Which, that's no secret, right? I went to 12 years of Catholic education. My parents paid probably $2,000 a year for me to go get it. They spent an enormous amount of money. My mother hates it when I tell this story. But when I left Catholic school, I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything at all. I can remember being a junior or a senior in high school, going up to receive Holy Communion, because my parents were very faithful Catholics, but they thought $2,000 is my duty. That's a lot of money. I'm paying someone to educate this kid in the faith. I'm doing my duty. I can remember going up to Holy Communion as a junior or senior in high school and posing the question to myself, saying, am I supposed to believe that this is a real presence, or am I supposed to believe that this is just a symbol? Right? That's a shame, to my great shame, that I went through a period of that in my life. But it means that we have a long period in which that I fall into that generation of where the faith was not brought across within the classroom and also in no other manner. So the importance of having that teaching and getting back to the basics of how in the world do we address in the end a sort of new evangelization? Because fundamentally the question also is addressed to the Fraternity of St. Peter, and it's also addressed to those who are present in its parishes. Now, I don't think that it's always a research in this department to sort of find the silver bullet, like we're going to set up this study group and this is really going to animate things within the life or whatever it might be. But the fundamental truth of it is that first and foremost, that Catholics need to simply know their faith, right? That you have to be motivated enough to simply say, this is something which is good to know in and of itself, so that it doesn't simply begin at the level of apologetics. You know, a lot of times when we hear things on the radio and everything else, and sort of a good Catholic movement, a strong Catholic movement, has been a lot of former Protestant pastors coming in and doing fine apologetics and doing real good, I believe, for souls. But the problem is that you have a tendency to see everything in a certain way as being ad extra with regard to the church. Catholics do. And even it can happen in this day and age of thinking that, well, I just have to learn my faith enough that I can talk to this person or convince that person or know these biblical arguments or whatever it might be. Those things certainly have to be known, right? But as the First Communion, I was asking some of those that are receiving catechism for First Holy Communion, the very first questions in the catechism go, you know, to know, love, and serve the Lord and be with him in the next. That's why we were put upon this earth. And when I used to teach catechisms, I would say to the children, why do they say no first, right? Because you can't love and you can't serve what you don't know, right? And so a huge deficiency on our part, because we're fundamentally lazy and because we fundamentally have far too many distractions in this world and we'd rather relax watching or listening to this or that rather than to pick up a good book and to read it, is that we have a real problem even in our own level of learning. And if you live in a non-territorial parish like this one, where you're probably not going to come every week to go to adult catechism, although that'd be really nice if you did, and it'd be a really good thing for your soul, you have to be dedicated at least in a different way to be able to learn that faith again, so that you know it yourself, so that then, as a next step, you can present it to the world in which you live. Because the world is badly in need of it. And Catholics need to be convinced fundamentally that if it's good for me, and if it gets me to heaven, then there has to be a zeal for your neighbor and for your neighbor's soul. All right? Now, it can't be unbridled zeal where you're going to do more damage than good. Right? It would be nice that if converting people were easy enough to wear a t-shirt that says Jesus saves, or something like that, or putting it on a bumper sticker. It would be nice if that's the way in which all conversions happen. It has to happen in an intelligent way, in a way in which, in an individual way, in which you talk to the person who's in front of you and you recognize what that person's needs are and what is going to really convince that person. But it's going to begin by the fundamental truths about the faith. I'll take just one example. One example is that is, in a certain way, the most paradoxical, that which would be typical of Chesterton. Chesterton says that the Catholic truth, which is the most obvious to everyone in the world, is fallen nature. He says, if there's one thing which everyone recognizes, it's the truth of fallen nature. Now, they probably don't believe in the fall. They probably don't believe that Adam and Eve fell within the garden or that there's original sin. But they believe that there's something wrong with human nature. They believe that it has a good side and that it has a capability of doing incredibly generous things, and they realize that it has an incredible tendency to being self-destructive, whether that be towards alcohol, bad relationships, whatever it might be, but that it has a capacity really for that. Well, that's a truth, right, that the Catholic Church understands and knows and can explain a good portion of reality and what people live because of the truth about original sin. Right? What St. Paul says, that there's a law within myself, and that which I want to do, I don't do, and that which I do wish to do, I don't do, and that which I don't wish to do, I do, right, is something that each one of us, and when you receive a convert into the church, they say, yeah, that really makes sense, right? That's something, and that's an area where our studies, for example, can be, in a way, something which is very helpful to those that with whom we are speaking. So this idea of education and of going back to the basics and of trying to form men at our seminary in a way in which they're able to bring that forward in the parish is something which is really important to the fraternity. Now, we call that scholastic philosophy or theology or the study of St. Thomas Aquinas, which we believe is not simply a philosophical system, so something that you learn because the world believes that philosophy, but something that explains reality. That's what it is. And that's why it's going to be the key towards bringing about conversions, and at the center of any kind of evangelization, whether it's the new one, whether it's the old one, whatever evangelization it might be. But that it has to begin with that core and with that teaching of the church. The second part of what happened then for these men that came to receive this education and to learn the faith in that way was obviously an attraction and what most people know the fraternity by, and that is by the old mass or the extraordinary form or the traditional mass or the traditional Latin mass, whichever moniker, whichever title you want to give to it. And the fraternity of St. Peter believes that the answer to the difficulties and the crisis within the society in which we live and within the church is really fundamentally through the liturgy. And that has to happen through those also seeing the liturgy and not just simply learning the catechism. Right? Often give the example that, you know, we say in English that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And they say that in a world of the internet now, a picture is probably worth 1,000,000 words because no one reads anymore, so words are cheap. And an image is worth a ton, right? And I think I probably told this story the last time I was here, but oftentimes when I go to visit bishops, they'll often say to me, yeah, at least at the beginning, it happened much more. Say, well, you know, you have this Latin mass, but you know, no one understands Latin anymore, and the kids aren't going to understand Latin, and I just don't see, like, why that's going to be important for these kids, you know, and this isn't going to be something which is going to be good. But as every priest will tell you, the Latin Mass is much more important for the kids than it is for the adults, right? They learn and they're much more perceptive of what they see than anything else. So that if I were a priest and I were preaching a sermon on First Holy Communion Day, and if I said everything which was true about the real presence and the Blessed Sacrament and how wonderful it is to have this gift and that this is really and truly Christ, but if I go back to the altar and I treat the sacred species as if they were bread in a common manner, right, and not as if they were every single particle is our Lord Jesus Christ, then that picture is worth much more than the sermon, right? The children who are present on that day walk out the back not having that same recognition. I may have told the story the last time too, but I'm not afraid to repeat myself. But every priest has probably had this experience where we go and we visit people's houses, because I used to be a real priest. And I used to have a parish life, and I used to have all those things. And I used to go over to people's houses for dinner. And typically, when you get invited over, not typically, but it happens when you get invited to people's houses, they'll say, oh, you know, the youngest one who's 5, he wants to show you how he says Mass after dinner tonight. Right? And so I can distinctly remember Jacob Kasak, who was a young boy in Sacramento, California. And he's now an organist, and he's 16 or something. I don't know how old he is. But I can remember his mother saying, would you mind if Jacob, you know, said Mass for you after dinner? I said, well, that'd be fine. And so so we went over to the hearth. We went over to the fireplace, which is about his height for a brick altar. And he sat his sister down at the piano very firmly and said, you know, you stay there. And as the organist, and he put his brother as the server next to him. And his mother said, you know, it's driving me around the bend because he has to have everything. You know, every time that he goes in the sacristy, he says this or that. He wants me to make him, you know, this for his chalice or that. And so, but when I was distinctly recall from Jacob playing Mass that day, as he had a little candy of some kind that he was pretending to be the host, and he elevated the host over his head. He put the host back down, and from that point on until the end of the Mass, he kept his fingers like this, right? So the whole time until he had washed his fingers, he kept his fingers closed like this. And I thought to myself on that day, I've probably preached on the Blessed Sacrament. I've been here 5 years in Sacrament. Probably preached on the Blessed Sacrament 15 times in front of this boy. But the best thing that I ever did for that boy was keeping my fingers closed. And when he's adult and he has doubts or he looks back or whatever it might be, that's going to be the image in his mind and not anything that I said. And that's the importance, really, of the liturgy for us. And that importance of the liturgy is something which is really underlined, not only, I think, by the Fraternity of St. Peter, but, you know, we had a wonderful friend in Pope Benedict XVI. Pope Benedict XVI, really, out of all of the different bishops that I've met in the world, is the one who understood the Fraternity of St. Peter the best, by far. I don't mean the most out of all the popes. I mean the most out of all the bishops that I've ever met. He really understood the purpose and the reason for the old Mass and the reason for the fraternity doing the old Mass. I can remember that one of the first questions he asked me when I walked in, he said, I sat down. We sat down. He sat down. Then I sat down at his desk. And the first question that he popped out with, he said, "Do you have any problems?" And I thought, oh, no, he knows the fraternity has problems. So I said, well, you know, we have problems with finding enough men to send to formation for the seminary or whatever it might be. And he said, no, everyone has those problems. He said, do you have any problems with bishops? That's what I'd like to know. So he then went through the world kind of saying this one, that one, and asking different questions. And he really understood the situation overall and the need and the importance for the Latin Mass and the full liturgy to be present in all of these different parishes and in all of these different places and in these dioceses. So one of the wonderful things, and I often bring up this quote, but is that in his book on the liturgy, the spirit of the liturgy, Cardinal Ratzinger at the time says that having a good liturgy is essential for the society in which we live. Now, it might be easy to say having a good liturgy is essential for the church, which it is, but he says having a good liturgy is essential for society as a whole. And the argument that he makes is a rather simple one. It's a little bit long, but I'll go into it. He says that society is based upon relationships, and when relationships are not understood or break down within a society, you no longer have a good society. So he said when husband and wife no longer understand their relationship, society begins to break down. What do we have? We have a new definition of marriage within the society in which we live, right? An attempt to define marriage in a different way, and we see that this is so destructive for the society in which we live. He says, when a father and a son don't understand their relationship, when they think they're just two buddies, rather than being a father and a son, then society begins to fall apart. When the boss and the worker no longer understand their role in helping to save one another, rather than just seeing it as a mere business exchange, which communism sees it as being, or a conflict in between the two, then society is going to fall apart as a whole. But the next step that the Holy Father takes is he says that in order to have good relationships in society, there has to be a good liturgy. And why? Because every single relationship within society is fundamentally based upon our relationship with Christ. And if we don't understand how we relate to God, how we stand before God, then we can't understand how we relate to the other person who is in front of us. So the famous book of Fulton Sheen, Three to Get Married, he talks about Christ being in a relationship. Why? Because you can't understand really finally what marriage is unless you understand it in relation to God, right? Unless you understand that the promise that these two people have made to one another is much higher than just a simple contract or exchange that they might make at their bank, that it's something which is much higher than that. And the next step for Cardinal Ratzinger is to say that this relationship to God is fundamentally defined and lived within the liturgy. And when the liturgy doesn't express any longer that relationship to God, that's going to be problematic for the society as a whole. And so one of the wonderful things which you see, hopefully, within the traditional Mass, is that always and fundamentally you understand your humility and how small you are compared to who you approach at the altar, right? That you start with a confession right from the very beginning. We even say it within the Mass. We say right before, every time before we say the Our Father, the priest says, and we have the audacity to say Our Father, right? It's interesting that we say we have the audacity to say it because we're so used to saying Our Father. But we have to remember that that's a supernatural invitation on the part of God, which is transformative in us by grace to make us a child of God, which allows us to address God as being Father in the first place. So that stresses the gap which is really there. And the fundamental act which is there with regard to the Mass, which is showing adoration towards God. It's giving God simply his due. So we're always talking about how we owe everyone else their due, right? And whether it be fellow man, or whether it be the pigeons, or whether it be the animals, or whatever it might be. But we never talk about what is really truly due to God and what is due to be given back to him. And the only place that's given is that's given in the liturgy, right? Because what is due to God is piety. What we owe to our parents, for example, is piety. Piety is like justice in that we owe someone something back for what they've given us. But in the end, we can't pay back the full debt. That's what piety is about. So children, you owe your parents piety, which means for the rest of your life, you'll be trying to show to them, right, your love, your devotion, your appreciation in a way that you'll never be able to pay back what they've really given you, which is life and the faith. You can't say to your mom or your dad, here's life, here's the faith, whatever it might be. They gave that to you, and you can never fully give that back. That has to be our understanding every single time when we come to the altar as well. And that's why it's an interesting part, but it gets into Protestantism. It's a bit of a sidebar, but St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the first things he talks about for the virtue of religion is he talks about sacrifice. And he says that every religion, if it's a true religion, has sacrifice. Right? Even the pagan religions, because what is sacrifice? Sacrifice is taking your first fruits, what's the very best that you have, and giving it to God. Right? And that's why Protestantism fundamentally is abhorrent as far as a religion goes, is because it gets rid of sacrifice as an element which man should continually give to God. Abhorrence may be a strong word, but that it falls the furthest away from what is natural religion, which is offering sacrifice to God. So that other element which is there, the liturgical side for the fraternity, is something which is important. Now, fundamentally, what's important with the manner in which we do it? Hopefully what's important is what's seen here, for example, at St. Joseph's. What's important is that the liturgy is done in that way, right? A low mass is the same sacrifice as the high mass. But in the end, everything that goes around the liturgy, all of the different elements which seem so secondary in a certain way, are elements which the church in its liturgy sees as being really important because it all underlines that sense of sacrifice and giving the very best to God. So, for example, probably maybe talked about it, but the laws for candle wax, right? At least 50% of the candle has to be beeswax, or 51%. Why? You know, paraffin is probably just as good. It burns just as well, right? But it's not as expensive. It doesn't show the sacrifice to the same degree. And so only that is used. Only cut flowers are allowed to be put on the altar. You can't have big plants on the altar. Why? Because the plants are cut because they're offered. They're a sacrifice. They gave their lives in a certain way, if you can call it the life of the plant, to God. They're offered as a sacrifice as well. So all of those elements, in the end, underline that level of sacrifice. And the same thing happens with the serving. The same thing happens with regard to the choir. The same thing happens with all of those hours that are put into it that we don't fully see. All of those things are an act of sacrifice of offering something really and truly to God. That's why, in a certain way, the choices of the fraternity of St. Peter are going to be different in a way on both sides. We're very different in a lot of ways from other parishes that do it in one way, but also different, for example, than the Society of Pius X, in saying that it's not the purpose of the fraternity of St. Peter to be in every place, right? We don't fundamentally try to set it up so that we have a priest in one place and he goes to five other places on the Sunday and makes sure that every single one of those places is going to have the Latin Mass. The purpose of the fraternity of St. Peter is not that. That's an intentional choice with regard to the way in which we see what we bring to the church as far as bringing about and aiding with regard to reform. And that won't happen without what you have here. And I hope that it grows stronger every single day, which is a real parochial life. Now, that real parochial life demands a lot of sacrifices because some of you sacrifice much more than we do. You come 45 minutes, you come an hour and a half away, you give your entire Sunday to God, and half of it turns out that it's in the car rather than simply being in church. But with all of those things, in the end, it's going to be, and we should have faith in it, that it's going to be something which is going to be a great thing for the church going forward. That parishes like that are like this one here at St. Joseph's are going to be a place where people can really look and say, this is indeed what parochial life can be. This is indeed what it should be, with a full Catholic life which is offered. Not just simply coming in on Sunday, leaving after that Sunday, but receiving the catechism, receiving just simply what you have today with this lunch, which is Catholics getting together, talking, families, children being together, and all the rest of it that goes with it. So, insofar as making that choice, one of the things that I wanted to bring across for the 25th anniversary of the fraternity or within this talk is that the fraternity has made a choice as a religious order or as a society of apostolic life within the church. And we serve the church in a very limited and particular way, right? The fraternity of St. Peter is not going to save the church, right? It's a part of a much greater whole, right? And of many people who are trying to do the right thing and pull in the same direction, and we contribute to that work which needs to be done. Right? I can tell you that. We have, since the motu proprio, we've been fortunate enough to train probably about 150 different Novus Ordo or diocesan and religious priests how to say the old Mass. Right? And they come to our seminary and they stay there for a week or they stay for 10 days. It's the greatest thing that we ever did for our seminarians. Why? Because they come to the seminary and they say, you are so lucky to be at this seminary. You can't believe what I went through in the 60s and the 70s and what my next door neighbor was doing and what the atmosphere was like within the seminary and what would happen to me if I showed any Marian devotion or anything else. They would say, just count your blessings that you're here, which is great, right? As a superior in the rector, you're like, yeah, you know, you're lucky to be here. You've got it good. You need to appreciate what you received, right? But the other thing that's wonderful is that we've had an opportunity to see these priests come and learn and to see these priests say, this is something that I want at the center of my priesthood. I feel robbed that I never had this and that I never learned this right from the very beginning. And for many of them, it's an eye-opener to see not only simply, because we don't have simply a training which is put your hands here, put your hands there, do this, do that, but it's much more than that. Why does the priest do these things at the altar? And first and foremost, what in the world are you doing at the altar in the first place? Are you going to say Mass on your day off? Why would you say Mass on your day off? Because it's the most important thing that you'll do during the day. That's a saying of Archbishop Lefebvre. A priest who has said his Mass well on that day has done 90% of his work for the church. Right? And that's not to encourage priests to be lazy with the other 23 hours that they have during their day. But the truth of the matter is that the priest has to have in mind fundamentally that the best thing that he does by far is just offering that sacrifice, renewing that sacrifice once again to God the Father for the remission of sins, for graces for the entire church, right? And if a priest can have that as a takeaway when he comes and when he learns at one of these sessions, then that's something which is truly a blessing and something which is good for the church. At the same time, it's humbling, right? It should be humbling for us as priests of the Fraternity of St. Peter. I oftentimes, because you probably hear this objection, people probably say to you, you know, well, you're one of those people that has to go to the Latin Mass. Who do you think you are? You know, or our Mass really isn't good enough for you, or whatever it might be. And certainly our priests have that to a degree. I always tell our priests, when you go into a meeting of diocesan priests, when we start out in a diocese, everyone's going to look at you like you have two heads. Everyone's going to look at you and say, oh, that's the one that's not okay with saying what we do. And you have to break the ice. It takes a lot of work to say, you know, no, I don't think that I'm better than you. And fundamentally, the attitude that those who go to the traditional Mass need to have is one of profound humility, because the old Mass wasn't made for those who are holy. The old Mass was made for those who are not holy. Right? The old Mass was made for those who are weak. The old Mass is made for those who need all of those signs and symbols and prayers to underline and reinforce the reality of what's going on at the altar. Right? If you were incredibly holy, if you were stripped from your human nature to a certain degree, you could go and just say the words of consecration and that would be the Mass. That would be it. That would be enough. But what we need is that full build-up to dispose us to the graces which are there, right? And then after, in the midst of that Thanksgiving. And that's what's really done fundamentally at the Mass, right? Is all of those concrete helps, right? So I always say, you know, I wasn't holy enough. And that's really true. I don't think it's false humility. That's really true. I wasn't strong enough to just go to a diocesan seminary and to go offer the new rite. I needed, and I need continually, all those supports that support the reality of what's really going on at the altar and is strengthening my prayer, which is really there. So the work for the fraternity, and I hope the work which is there on the part of the faithful, has to be one in which we also see the larger picture. Right? And that takes it sort of to the third element, which is really there of the Fraternity of St. Peter. And that is that we're named after St. Peter, we're named after the Prince of the Apostles, and so we like to think that our work should really be one with regard to the Holy See, with regard to reconciliation, and with regard to helping people to understand with regard to the Magisterium, with regard to the Mass, and with regard to the Church as a whole, which is a piece of work, right? It's important for us that the children who go to a chapel or go to a church of the Fraternity of St. Peter don't see that as being their chapel or their church and that's it, right? We belong to a greater whole. We're Catholics, right? We belong to a hierarchy. We belong to the church. And therefore, it is a much bigger picture of things altogether, right? And that's something which is a fundamental Catholic attitude, right? That you belong to something which is much larger and something which is much greater than yourself. Now, that work, which is done by the fraternity in a certain way, is the most important because it means, hopefully, trying to see things really for the reality which it is in the world in which we live. I probably said it the last time I was here, but I come from Minnesota where it's deathly cold, right? And you know in Minnesota that if it's wintertime, you better tell your kids that it's wintertime. You better not tell them it's summertime, right? So there is no shame for a mother to say to her child, it's wintertime, you better be properly dressed when you go outside, right? So you put on your snowmobile suit, you put on your mittens, you put on your hat, you put on your scarf, you get all wrapped up. And if you go out in the middle of winter and you're fully dressed, you're going to be okay. You're going to survive. It's not the end of the world, winter. But it would be a huge mistake for that mother to say, it's summertime, head on out in your shorts, right? And the same thing is true with regard to the situation within society and the situation within the church. There's no use saying that we're in the springtime or in the summertime of the church. It's not true. That's not the truth, right? There are difficulties, there are realities, there are problems which are there. There are reforms which need to take place, and that reform starts with the priesthood, right? Because the church is hierarchical, and it starts with us as priests. It's one of the wonderful things about the years of Benedict XVI was the year of priests, which was clearly aimed at saying, if the priest himself is not convinced, then what about the flock, right? It's wonderful to have wonderful laymen, and they're absolutely necessary. And goodness knows they've carried a lot over these years, but the prayers for the priests and the reform of the priesthood is the most essential thing and the most essential work which is there for the church. But so it doesn't mean that the fraternity of St. Peter should see things in a Pollyannish manner, to say, oh, this is all going well and it's perfect and, you know, this is perfect here and this is perfect there, when that's not the truth of the situation. But at the same time, it means seeing the church in its whole. It means being patient. It means, I think, to a certain degree, part of what was in the sermon today, which is not being worried about those things which you cannot control, right? Not being solicitous for what's not your responsibility. And what I said about CNN, I think, can also easily be said about a lot of Catholic blogs, probably, right? I went to the seminary this last time, and I told them, boy, I bet if we watched the traffic at the seminary during recreation, we could have seen exactly what was being followed after every action of Pope Francis, right? There would have been a huge spike in traffic at these websites and then a huge spike in traffic on another one. And everything follows it. It goes up and down like a yo-yo. Pope Francis said this, and it's terrible news, and we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Oh, no, now he said this, and actually it's pretty great, and he's really, really, really more traditional than we thought. Oh, no, then this is going to be a problem. And Catholic Church has existed for 2,000 years. It's probably going to exist for another 2,000. I mean, I'm not a prophet. Maybe the end of the world is coming tomorrow. But it's probably going to last a lot longer, right? And the church is going to go through a lot of different things. And if we're always sort of on the breach and always saying, well, you know, what's the latest news are we going to make tomorrow? Is the Fraternity of St. Peter going to still exist? Are we going to still have the old Mass? It's no way to live your life as a Catholic, right? I mean, be worried that you're disciplining your kids in the right way and giving them the education in the true sense of the term that you need to do, and that's going to be really the good which is there for your child and what you need to do. So that view of the church, I think, in a broader level, and also having to do looking at the church historically, is something that's really important for all of us as Catholics. And again, not as easy to do in the United States. I still remember the first time that I landed, Father Novakovsky and I both landed, I think, in the same city in France when we first landed, different years, but in Lyon. And I remember landing, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, seeing castles and seeing cathedrals that were from the 12th century and thinking, you know, these are things that I just saw in books as a kid. I thought that knights and princesses and princes were things of fables, and that was really about it, and that, you know, it never really was there. But it also puts it into perspective when you go there, the length of the history of the church and everything that it's been through over centuries and centuries and the difficulties which it has faced. So when we look at this time, which is certainly, to a certain degree, filled with uncertainty, there are many things that need to be clarified. There are many different things that have been taught in part or in half that I would like to see clarified, that the fraternity would like to see clarified. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. Right? It's not going to happen tomorrow. I gave a talk earlier in Charlotte about a year ago, and it was for the Year of Faith, and it was on Vatican II and the Council of Ephesus. And it's a little bit too complicated and for a festive day, and this talk is all long enough already. But the idea behind it is that the teaching at that time was on Christology. In the Council of Ephesus, the whole problem was the two natures of Christ, divine and human, and the one person. And hard for theologians to figure out at that time in what way the two natures came together but not did not become one nature. And there's one phrase within the Council of Ephesus which is very difficult to interpret in the right light. It tends to be read as saying that there are two natures before the union and there's only one nature after, right, which would be heretical. And it's in the Council of Ephesus. That was later corrected by the Council of Chalcedon. Now, the Council of Chalcedon didn't come along and say the church fathers at Ephesus were all modernists and they were all heretics and they didn't believe the truth about Christ and they didn't preach it, so we're here to correct it and we're throwing out the Council of Ephesus. Right? It didn't happen. The Council of Chalcedon is mainly based upon St. Leo the Great, right, and his tome to Flavian, St. Flavian, and it simply states the truth. Right? It clarifies it without condemning what came before it. And that's how the magisterium of the church functions. Right? So to wait or to hope or to think that there's going to be a condemnation of this or that which was taught 50 years before or 40 years before is not going to happen. It's not how the church functions. It's not going to happen. Right? It's going to happen simply by having the time and giving the time and having the patience with the situation in the church for an unclarified situation. The Fraternity of St. Peter, for example, considers its duty, and I spend a lot of my time in Rome talking to bishops and trying to talk to them really about and encourage them in the right direction on different teachings and on different disciplines which are there. But one of the things that we've done is that we've sent in letters and we've said, you know, this passage is very hard to reconcile with this other passage. What can be done? And the response was given, this is too difficult and can't be addressed right now by the church in a public manner. We can't do it, right? Which is understandable or prudent in a certain way. It has to be the judge of the one who leads that can be the prudent thing. Most recently, when Pope Francis had some rather ambiguous things to say about conscience, which I'm sure that all of you read, and there was a huge uproar which was there and a lot of worry, the Fraternity of St. Peter spoke with another group in France, which is Chemre le Roi, which are the quasi-Dominicans who are in France, and a letter was written by the Dominicans in France. It was sent to the Holy Office. It said, you know, this is St. Thomas's understanding of the conscience. A faulty conscience is not something that has any rights. It can't be followed. And if you consider it to be prudent, we would ask you to present this to the Holy Father because we don't think that the way in which he stated that can fit with what the Church teaches about conscience. And that if he thinks that it's going to be prudent, that he could state that in a different manner later on. Right? That's the work of the Fraternity of St. Peter, not to go forward and to say, you know, look at this person, look at the Pope, look at our Holy Father, you know, this is a problem. The work which is done is the work in the same way that a father would present, or a child would present himself to a father, right? And that's what we agreed to with the protocol of May the 5th. And the protocol of May the 5th that the fraternity accepted is not a muzzle. It's not to silence the fraternity, like, oh gee, we wish we could say everything that we want to, but if we really want parishes and we really want to fit in, we can't talk about things. The question is, what's the proper way, what's the role of the theologian within the church to talk about subjects that are there within the church, right? And hopefully, we're faithful to it. I think that we're lazy sometimes. I think that we could do a better job studying our own theology and staying sharp on things, but I think that it's the right approach and the right way. So I've gone a little bit longer than I hoped, and that means certainly longer than you hoped. I want to thank you in closing just for your support of our priests. I'm a superior who lives about 1,000 miles away from his priest. I'm sure there's some days when they really appreciate that and they think that that's not such a bad deal to have their superior so far away. But in another way, it means that our priests are just two in a house. That's a very small community for a society of apostolic life or for a religious life. And so we count immensely on the faithful who are there within the parish to really support them. And neither one of them looks like they're starving to death. They're both doing pretty well. And more importantly than that,
it's a small community.
More importantly than that, it seems to me that they're both doing well as far as just having a good balance of the apostolic word and the spiritual life which ought to be there. And I appreciate that. And I think that it's important that to realize that your role with regard to your priest in encouraging them to be active and to give them everything that you need and to keep them busy is a wonderful thing, but also encouraging them to make sure that time for prayer is really there is an excellent thing and so important for our priests as well. So as a superior who used to deal much more with the faithful and now I deal with priests, I know how much they need prayers. And I would ask you really for your prayers for our priests and also for your our men in formation. You have the poster up. You see the men who are there. There are another about 80 seminarians who are in Wiegratzbad, Germany, and then priests who are in all different spots throughout the world. And most of them are two or three gathered. So to keep those priests in your prayers, I would greatly appreciate it. And then I think most importantly, perhaps, is that we should never take it for granted. I always tell the priests, look at how many orders have fallen away from what they were originally set up to do. I remember talking to a Salesian that we used to have in the seminary, and he said that, well, my order rewrote the constitutions, which, of course, were written by St. John Bosco. And the reason was given is that we want to write it in this true spirit of St. John Bosco, was the reason for rewriting the constitutions. So no order is immune from falling away from what it was originally set out by the church to do. And certainly the fraternity could easily fall into that. We've had different temptations which have been there in the past, but hopefully we'll remain small, we'll remain humble, we'll do the little amount of work that we do, but we'll do it as well as we can to participate in the life of the church and remain faithful to it. So thank you very much for your prayers, especially those who are members of the confraternity, for our priests, and for the fraternity of St. Peter as a whole. God bless. There's a really good question. Maybe I'll take it. I don't know. Maybe it's too long.
No, he wants a good question. Anyone else?
No pressure.
A real barn burner.
Are you going to talk to a bishop?
No, I'm not going to speak to the bishop. I just came in just for the Sunday, and that's it. So tomorrow I leave. Tomorrow I head out. Yes?
Why does Opus Dei have a bishop?
Opus Dei has a bishop because they're a personal prelature, and so by definition they have a prelate. The fraternity is not a personal prelature. We're a society of apostolic life, and almost every society of apostolic life and religious order does not have a bishop. So most religious orders that are old have members who are bishops, but they're no longer involved in the order. So like the Holy Father, he's not involved with the Jesuits and hasn't been for a long time. So it's actually typical for a religious order not to have one. And we don't.
Are you going to, and if so, why are you going to move our beloved pastor in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Did you ask for him to move?
Not to be moved, because isn't it traditional for a pastor to be a pastor for his entire life?
So if he builds a rectory here, a permanent rectory, I promise to keep him for the years that I remain.
Here it is.
Well, no. I shouldn't say that. Unless there's an emergency. An assistant, I'm just going to say this. An assistant in the fraternity of St. Peter usually stays in his first assignment as a new priest 2 or 3 years.
Oh, who hiss?
I didn't say anything more than that. That's just typically what happens. We would like to keep pastors a longer amount of time, and we know how important it is to a place. And I think I said it the last time. I mean, the fraternity assumed the responsibility for this parish not that long ago, and so it's important, obviously, that the pastor stays, if it's possible for the fraternity to leave him here. So it all depends. He might have my job next, so.
We need a lot of help here. You can't take that.
Well, I should have started the sermon today by saying my first announcement is that nobody's moving, because then otherwise everyone just kind of sits there and waits and thinks, is he going to move him? Is he going to move him? What's going to happen? So, I'm not here to move the priest. That's the good news. But the good news is that the fraternity tries to open up about two places every year. We'll ordain 9 men at the seminary here in the United States this summer. And that means that we have the opportunity to open up 2 or 3 places. And if we open up 2 or 3 places, then the dominoes fall. You know, someone has to move up to the next one, and someone has to take on greater responsibility. And when you start a new apostolate from the ground, and you have to buy a church, you have to get the community together and everything else, I have to take a really seasoned well-seasoned priest to go ahead and do that. So that doesn't mean it'll be Father Novikowski, but it just means that it's a good problem to have as a superior, but it also means that the fraternity probably doesn't have the stability of its priest that the faithful would like and deserve to some degree. But if we're going to open up in places like Charlotte and everything else...
It is the thinking within the fraternity is that they typically want to shoot for three priests at a parish, or what is the goal there?
Here, I thought all the questions were going to be about my talk. I guess I'm an awfully vain man. the goal of the fraternity, really, I mean, the church says, supposedly, I've never found the exact quote, but community starts with three. And that a real community can't be structured just of two members, that you really should have three. I think that this will be a big enough apostolate where, and everything will fit together, where eventually three priests will be something that we'd like to have here. There are a few different places that have three, and we'd like to get there if we can. But there are a lot of things that's dependent upon. There has to be enough work for three, which there probably is to a degree. There has to be enough funds for three. That's something which is always a consideration.
We need to be cured.
But I'd like to see it get to three in most places. It's much better for the priests. Yes?
Father, I have one more. You made one statement that hit the nail on the head for me, and that is that Roman Catholics should be able to explain their faith. And my experience was that I had a college junior call me and said, I have friends who are asking me how the church justifies the perpetual virginity of the Blessed Mother. And I said, well, you have to say more than that's what Sister Immaculata told me in grade 5. That's not, okay, gonna hi-hat. You have to know the doctrine.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where we get into apologetics.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two things. You have to know the doctrine, and you have to really have a love of the soul who's in front of you. And I think that to a certain degree, our fear of things overcomes that, and we reply in one of two ways, either really harshly or in a way which is just overwhelming to the person who's in front of us, or to say nothing at all in a very embarrassed way. But if you look at Christ within the Gospels, right, he loves every soul that's in front of him. And he handles Pontius Pilate in a different way than he handles the sinning woman, and in a different way than he handles St. Peter. So I just want to make it clear that the way in which it's done, the best way is not always just saying, well, you know, if you're not Catholic, you're going to hell, right? That's rarely the best first line for someone. Sometimes it is. I mean, maybe. But you have to love the soul in front of you because you love Christ. And you have to say, like St. Therese, right, I want every single soul that was created to love him and adore him for all eternity to be there. And if you do, then I think that 90% of the time, you're going to say the right things. And it's even going to help you to overcome your fear of saying the right thing in which you need to say it. And certainly, there are many of you who know really difficult situations in families, even relatives. But that we have to constantly be looking for that conversation. Right? We have to be constantly looking for the opening. And it doesn't mean that you just deluge the other person and hit him over the head and drive him further away. But it means that always your principle of discernment is not, am I going to be embarrassed, but what's the best thing that I can do for this soul who's in front of me right now? Because that's Christ's attitude, right? And that has to be ours too. So. Okay. Well, you can all run out and play, or the children can run out and play. Or did you have a question?
No.
Give a grace after meals.
Yeah, I'll say grace after meals and then give you a blessing. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. We give you thanks, O Lord, for these and all the benefits, you who livest and reignest forever and ever. Amen. Benedictio de omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et maniat semper.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.